I'm having Stan Apsher on my show this morning. J.S. Apsher has been an offset printer, missionary, bank teller, janitor, and consultant, sold mutual funds, surveyed scrub timberland, and taught a poetry class in Belize. He's a member of the board of the North Carolina Poetry Society and co-hosts the monthly Second Thursday reading series at Flyleaf Books, an independent bookstore in Chapel Hill, N.C. Apsher's award-winning poetry has been published in numerous journals and been nominated for the Pushcart Prize. He has two collections, Night Weather, Sinosura Press, 2010, and The Burial of Annis Shepherd, Main Street Rag, 2006. Going to get to him in just a moment. Want to give a quick shout-out to the Historic Carolina Theatre of Durham, my underwriter, as well as the Apex Arts Council. Historic unto itself, we have the president on the board here. He's my co-host today.
Yes.
And that'd be Bob Crowley. Quick note that I thought folks would find of interest, since this is a literary show. Today is actually the anniversary of Huckleberry Finn, written by Mark Twain on this day in 1885. Thought that might be a point of interest. Welcome, Stan.
Thank you. Thank you, Claudio and Bob.
It's good to have you on, Bob. Might need to turn the mics up a little.
Do I need to sit closer?
Oh, I think you're fine.
Okay.
Bob's got the controls now. Mm-hmm. All right, we're happening. So, hey.
Hey, how are you?
The only thing I didn't mention was that you dance naked at weddings, which, of course, I'm told you don't, and I do, so...
Right, there you
go. We'll switch that part. So give us a little intro about what got you into all this. Have you always had a fascination for poetry or for writing?
Yes, my first recollection of liking poetry is in the third grade, where we had a language arts book, as they called it in those days. Excuse me. And it was a grass green cover. And the poem I remember is a little kid with a book sitting in an armchair. And as he's reading the book, the armchair sprouts wings, and he takes off flying. I don't remember the poem, but I remember the picture. It's a little short, I'm sure, a little rhyming poem. Seventh grade, I actually bought my first poetry book. And then we went on the standard North Carolina school trip to Chapel Hill and Raleigh. I bought a book by John Donne and one by William Blake.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you jumped right into the fire,
I jumped
didn't
right
you?
In, right. And, of course, I didn't know what I was reading, but I didn't care. I liked it so much.
It sounded good, didn't it?
It sounded good. It made me feel good. It made me move inside, but I didn't really care what it meant.
Sort of makes you want to explore the words, even though you don't understand
them.
They sound good. They feel good. And that's really what's lacking in writers today, that you find very few wordsmiths. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah. And I suppose I really started writing in ninth grade. Had a good friend who liked my writing. And would read it and give mostly praise.
Was it to you an early form of just expressing yourself, or were you just experimenting?
I think expressing myself.
Okay.
Expressing myself. And I remember the first poem I actually remember writing, I don't think it's the first one I wrote, but the one I remember, I was in 10th grade sitting behind a pretty girl, and I wanted to get her attention. So I wrote a poem.
That'll get you every time.
She didn't care. But I kept writing, so it wasn't a total failure.
Did you seduce her with your writing?
I did not. She was totally indifferent.
Oh, well. Can't win them all.
No, I can't win them all. But it was an interesting thing. I went to governor's school and was published in the little governor's school newsletter that was put out by the students. As an undergrad, I wrote quite a bit and was published in the local, this is at Brigham Young University in Utah, and I actually edited the student journal.
Where are you from originally, USA?
I am from northwestern North Carolina.
Okay, you were telling me Tom Dooley country, right?
Tom Dooley country, that's right.
Give us a little scenario there.
Well, my experience with Tom Dooley is limited, but it's kind of interesting. My dad always wanted to be an outside worker.
Mm-hmm.
He would rather dig ditches than be in an office, but he, in fact, was the VP of a bank. So one of the things he did that he loved doing was survey, and he liked to survey, as you said in the introduction, scrub timberland. He didn't want to do city lots where there was more money. He wanted to go out in the sticks.
Be in nature.
Be outside, take his machete, hack the sight line through so you could, see to the candy stick with the theodolite. And he wanted me to be the instrument man. That never actually worked out. I wanted to have the machete. and what I ended up doing is just carrying the chain. But one of the surveying we did was in the corner of Wilkes County near Tom Dooley's grave, and the survey trip took us walking through the woods carrying the equipment right past a spot, hole in the ground, that the locals said was where Tom Dooley originally buried Laura Foster.
That's wild. And, of course, Tom Dooley was – it is now believed that he was actually innocent of that.
That's time. Right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember his words from what I read where he realized his fate was closing in on him and that he had this amazing way of accepting his fate by just saying, well, I must have done something to earn this, even though he was not guilty of crime.
I think he was something of a ne'er-do-well, so that's my impression in any case. The story goes, well, it's true that Zebulon Vance, who had been governor of North Carolina during the Civil War.
Great name.
Great Zebulon. Name. Zebulon Vance, Zeb Vance, and he was a Whig, actually. I don't think he ever changed party affiliation.
So that's referred to as a Whig.
Whig.
Interesting.
W-H-I-G, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. He was Tom's defense attorney, to no avail. But the story is that I think the trial was in Statesville, and that Tom sat on his wagon and played the banjo or the guitar on the way to be hanged.
Oh, my goodness.
So that goes along with the sense you had.
The story I was telling Stan earlier while we were sitting around the studio here is that I became familiar with the legend of Tom Dooley in South Africa, listening to records of the Kingston Trio. And, I mean, that was a song, just you fell in love with the song because it's so well done. Never mind the sad story to go with it, but just such beautiful harmony by the Kingston Trio, you had to pay attention. Of course, as a result, you got curious as to what's this all about.
That's
and
right.
All of a sudden, one day I come to North Carolina, and now I meet somebody that's from his hometown. That's,
my mother's grandmother, my great-grandmother, used to say that they sang it to the wrong tune.
Oh, no.
So she had heard the song to a different tune, apparently.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I can imagine when they were first creating it, it having a few different flavors. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
But, of course, I think the one with the Kingston Trio stuck.
Yes, it did.
They had the better marketing.
Yeah, no
it
doubt.
Could be, right, yeah. Yeah.
They had the vocals, man. Those guys could harmonize. Yeah. You want to give us one of your poems?
Sure.
Let me introduce the poet at his work.
Okay. And can I introduce? I'll introduce Please the poem
do.
A little bit. So I've done, as we were talking about earlier before the show, I do a lot of tweeting, or a fair amount of tweeting, mostly micro poems, short poems, mostly in the haiku tradition.
Okay.
So I've done a fair amount of...
Define the haiku tradition, because not everybody listening is going to know.
Well, I'll do my best.
Okay.
There are people that are very particular about the haiku, and I'm not sure I can meet their high standards. But the haiku is a short, usually three-line poem that has some reference to the season that the poem is written in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime in Japanese, there's conventions. The references are conventional, right?
Okay.
New Year's Day means a certain...
Right, I can see it.
Or a certain... You mentioned a certain blossom, which tells you what season you're in, of course. The poems tend to avoid personification, metaphor, simile.
All right.
They try to capture this moment in time, this still moment in time, and nothing else. But, of course, it resonates. You know, it's written by Zen Buddhists, so it resonates very deeply spiritually and sends out a radiation in all directions. But the poem itself, when they really work, is just on that moment focused. So Basho was the first great master of haiku, lived in the 17th century. And the poem I'm going to read is based on a story that he wrote about himself in a book, a travelogue called a book about his first travels that he undertook in 1684 called The Travelogue of the Weather-Beaten Bones. He was 40. He lived 10 more years. He was kind of escaping the fame he'd already created. His hut had burned down. His mother had died, so he may have been what we would call depressed. That's obviously our term, not his. And it was pretty dangerous to be traveling the back roads of Japan, feudal Japan in the 17th century. When he started, he was felt in danger, but he grew kind of comfortable with the rhythm of travel, and he ended up doing three other travels after he finished this one. One incident that's actually pretty controversial, he is, by this time, when he writes this incident, he's gathered followers around him, and they're walking by a river, and they meet a child, he says, is probably 2 years old, sobbing pathetically. Abandoned in the woods. So he throws some food out of his sleeve to the child, and they walk on and leave the child there. And then he writes a poem about it, and he says, well, I don't think it's really because the mother didn't like it or the child or the father was irritated by it, but it's really because this was God's will that this happened to the child. This is at least one translation of that passage. Mm-hmm. So my poem is sort of picks up on that and sort of thinking about the ethical responsibility of, art versus life.
Basically. Right, okay.
Right. We last as long as the dew. A bird from out of nowhere flew from sky to earth, to shrub, to a bushy maple. I kept to the path that wound between trees and looped around the maple, almost rejoining itself. I read as I walked, from line to line, looping and darting to follow the images that flitted and called. Like the bird, they chirped a language from out of nowhere, one I longed to know above all things. When we came to a river, the bird vanished, leaving behind a sobbing child, maybe 2 years old, a castaway on the roaring river of the world. I flung a blanket at her and ran. I gave her nothing but walked away, soothing myself with the cheeping book. I tossed her by the foot into the river. I sold her on the street. I said the village should take her in. My life is mine, I said, to wander with book and pen till I am their master. She is many, I said, and I am one. Another image from the book came to mind. The petals of a bush that scatter on the first autumn breeze. Can you find them in spring? I cradled the child in my arms and felt her beating heart. I gave her rice cake softened in water. I did something that will always be the most important thing I did.
Beautiful. I like the rhythm of it and the variable of stories that it tells.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things, and of course the haiku I've written don't really do this, but a lot of the other poetry I've written is narrative or narrative lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And I find I'm often attracted to choices that people are making or to the consequences of choices, or to put it another way, love gone bad. You know, when love has not worked out or community has not worked out,
right,
what the consequences of that are. So this is just an expression of that.
Nicely done.
Yeah, thank you.
Give us another. And then we'll go to a musical interlude.
Okay, all right. This one is after a grim fairy tale, and it is kind of a grim poem.
Not to be confused with the Brothers Grimm.
Not to be confused with, but it's called The Boy Who Waved, and it's really taking a short Grimm fairy tale, turning into and turning it into a syllabic poem. The Boy Who Waved. A boy would never do what his mother said, so the Lord made a bramble scratch the door to death in the cold ground. But his little hand kept poking through the dirt to reach fresh air, warm sun, the earth's green light. When they pushed it down, it popped back up again, waving hello. Mother, they cried, you must do something. So she swatted the hand with a switch till it waved goodbye. Some say his hand became the sink foil that creeps across graves, or the white morning glory that dies each day when the bloom is young, but winds and fiercely binds itself to life.
You're listening to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre. The poems that you just heard were recited by Stan Apsher. And we're going to go to a moment of music with Deborah Wiedekind. And I believe the song we're going to is Let's Fall in Love. I just like the way she does this tune. Lady from Texas. And it looks like we're having some further technical difficulties. Give us just a moment here, see if we can get this song right.
Why is this not? Oy vey.
All right, that's okay. Put my mic back on. Let's go back.
You're
no, I'm not on. Thank you. Now I'm on. There we go. All right, I'm going to let you fiddle with the musical part. I'm actually going to do a little delivery of my own from my book, Seafarer. I'm going to add a compliment of poetry to my friend here, Stan Apsher, in the studio today. And then we'll continue on. Looks like we've got some trouble with the music machine. Got a piece here called A Drunken Sailor. I think it's what people expect to hear when they hear about the sea. This is from my book, Seafarers, which is also a stage production. A drunken sailor. The sailor set his battered sails upon many a restless sea, though now as the autumn wind prevails, it's home to land for me. I've spent my rum and tonic nights sailing her angry tides, though now as I see the harbor lights, all memory subsides. I'll head for shore as I've done before, and rest my weary soul, but not before, land sakes galore, some rum and rock and roll. There'll be some jokes amongst the blokes as the booze begins to flow, and then some weed to numb the creed from things they don't choose to know. They'll all be looking forward to several weeks of sail. A shake of hands a friend demands, and it's off to no avail. Well, I'll spend this night in tropics I may never see again, and I'll speak of many topics I may never free again. I'll be drinking with the runners who hide within these aisles, and I'll drink a toast to sunners who've come to change their styles. Yes, I've seen my better days at sea and the last of this bottle of rum, so I warily set my memory free of these islands in the sun. Though before I sleep without solution, for even a drunk has resolution, I must take to heart this last desire, for it ain't the rum that burns like fire. Well, I'll set my sails if but once more, and just for old time's sake. Then from the ocean to the shore, I'll live on a fisher's take. So once again I'll sail my dreams across this restless sea. And once again, it seems, I'm home at last and free. Are we ready for a tune?
I hope so.
Let's give it a try one more time.
Made for it, let's take a chance. Why are you afraid of it? Let's close our eyes and make our own paradise. Little we know, but still we can try to make a go of it. We might have been meant for each other to be. Let's fall in love.
We are back. I want to make a little apology for some of the technical glitches here. It's like Claudio says, I'm not 100% used to the board, but we're getting there.
Don't worry about that. I mean, it's going to happen. I think folks out there realize that we're flying a puddle jumper once in a while.
Yeah, well, I don't jump puddles real well.
It's okay. I can imagine. That's one of the reasons I never work the board is because I find it terribly distracting to the conversation that needs to go on. So anyway, we're back with Stan. Thank you, Bob, for mentioning that, though. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And you were going to cue us into a few more details here.
Yes, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Flyleaf. We call it the Second Thursday reading series because, surprisingly enough, it's on almost always on the second Thursday of the month, starting at 7.
And Flyleaf is a bookstore.
Flyleaf is an independent bookstore on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Chapel Hill next to the Fosters. So it's in a well-known location. We have been doing the reading since March 2010. We have had 80-plus mostly readers, authors, almost all of them poets, who've appeared. And we've had poet laureates past and present of North Carolina.
Fantastic.
Academic poets, community poets, for want of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly published poets, but a handful of self-published poets when the work merits it.
Right.
And I think that there's a great shout-out we should make to Jamie Fiocco, who's the owner of or co-owner of Flyleaf Books. She has been easy to work with, wonderful.
That's good.
The space, if you haven't been to the space,
not lately, years ago.
It's an absolutely gorgeous reading space that she has.
Fantastic.
That's set off from the rest of the bookstore. Nice new sound system. And for the readers, there's a clock in the back, so they can so I've never had to use the hook on anyone so far.
Good. I've had to do that on stage at the theater.
You know, I've often thought I have to do that, but, you know, a couple of people ran a minute or two late, but no one's really ever abused
I've actually
the time
found myself having to realize, I've dealt with a few hams that were overly impressed with themselves, even though they were very good at what they were doing. Yeah. I would say, listen, you've got 10 minutes, 20 at the most is all I can give you as an opening act for the person coming on. And if you do not finish at that time, I'm going to embarrass you. I've got no problem walking up on stage and saying, he must go now, folks. Thank you very much for listening. It's always worked.
Yeah. So some other names I mentioned, Deborah Kaufman. Actually was – so this first started as sponsored by Scott Douglas, who's the publisher – a poet in his own right and the publisher of Main Street Rag. So for the first year, he kind of sponsored this. It was a great experience. And he and Jamie, I'm not sure who, but they first recruited Deborah Kaufman, who's a great poet and playwright, to come to be the host. And she recruited me to be the co-host.
Fantastic.
It's been a wonderful experience, something I would never have volunteered for. But I accepted because I trusted Deborah, and it's been a great experience. She recently stepped back because she has all kinds of writing and editing projects going on. And my new co-host is Pam Baggett, also a very fine poet, a local poet. So it's been a great experience. We meet second Thursday at 7.
I was going to say, you have an ongoing thing.
Yeah. An ongoing thing. The Flyleaf address online is flyleafbooks.com.
Okay.
And my email, for those who are interested, is stanabsher, all one word, at hotmail.com.
And that's A-B-S-S-H-E-R.
A-B-S-H-E-R at hotmail.com. Happy to get your emails and chat with you about it. And the other thing we have, and other people have said this, so I don't think I'm unduly bragging, we have one of, if not the best, open mic in the area.
Good.
So we usually have each reader reads for 20 minutes. Then we have a short break, and then we have usually 30 to 40 minutes for an open mic. And the variety and quality of the poems is really quite astounding.
And what time frame does the open mic
It usually starts about 10 to 8 and goes to 8:30.
Okay.
Occasionally runs over a little bit.
And it's just people randomly coming up and expressing whatever they want.
Yeah. Normally they have written poems ahead of time.
Right.
But yes, I mean, pretty much whatever they want to read, they can read. They normally have a fairly short time frame, maybe 2 minutes, because we want to make sure everyone who's there has a chance to read. That's one of the major constraints.
And I imagine that sort of thing is popular all over the area.
It is. There are lots of very good open mics, but I do want to brag on mine.
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing we do, and this year will be the fourth year, we have a poetry contest. Usually opens around July 1st. Then we have the winner, the runner-up, and the honorable mentions read at our the October reading.
And how's this contest coming about?
We allow, if the rules are the same as in the past, we'll allow each poet to send a single poem. We have a length of, I forget, 70 lines or something. It'll be in the rules. Three nice things about this contest: no entry fee, which
is nice.
Pretty unusual.
Yeah.
The prize in the past, and I imagine it'll be the same this year, is a $150 gift certificate from Fryleaf Books for winning first place.
Wonderful.
So that's a nice size prize.
It is.
And then there's a smaller gift certificate for the runner-up, and then for the honorable mentions, the opportunity to appear.
Wonderful.
That's
as fair as it can be.
It is. And we have, this last year, 65 poets entered.
And fantastic.
Some very well-known poets, some very nice poems. One of the nice features, if you're a poet, is that, maybe this is neutral. Some people like it, some don't. We don't publish the poem. So that means you could win this and still publish your poem somewhere else.
Right.
So that's, I think, a plus.
So it's not some sort of an anthology dedicated to the situation.
That's right.
Just poems we enjoy.
Just poems we enjoy. And they can be previously published. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
That leaves it wide open.
Yeah. So that's been a really interesting. And we always get, the first year I got a couple of local poets to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 2 years, I've had out-of-state poets. And the submissions are blind. They have no name on them.
I got you.
But the out-of-state poet means, I think, that a better chance that it's a fair reading of the poems and no...
Yes, no, I fully appreciate
accidental favoritism just because they recognize whose poem it
right,
is.
No,
right,
no, I totally understand that. Yeah. Well, I'd be very interested in entering myself. So
I hope you do.
Keep in touch by email.
Yeah. You're on the mailing list, I think. So
yes, I think I am.
Yeah.
Let's go to another one of your pieces of work.
Okay, well, so one of the things that attracts me about writing, and I think I remember reading Rita Dove say this, and I think it's true of many poets. Well, a lot of poetry comes out of your life, but at least in my case, the older I get, the more it comes out of other books.
Mm-hmm.
So my life gets added to it and filters it and makes it, the poem become a poem,
mm-hmm.
but the influences of what I've read and what I've seen become a really major part of it. So this particular poem, which was an honorable mention in the Cackalack this year, is called The Depot. It combines several features, several phrases and influences from several places. So one is it has two paraphrases from Shakespeare's sonnets.
All right.
It's one of the works I've read over and over and over again. And I've read, Stephen Booth has a great book on Shakespeare's sonnets, as does Helen Vindler. Both of those books are extremely detailed, almost excruciating close readings of the sonnets. But if you're a poet, it's great.
Where can one find these books?
I think they're both still in print.
Does Flyleaf have them?
Probably not. But if you want to buy a used book at a nice price, I could set you up.
Okay, good. Well, you have the contact, folks.
But Helen Vindler and Stephen Booth. Helen Vindler's book's a little more recent. So that's one influence. Another is Napoleon Hill wrote Think and Grow Rich,
mm-hmm.
right? Great, famous book. Not
yes.
a great book, but a famous book
right.
that my father read and thought but didn't grow rich. Napoleon Hill was from Tazewell, Virginia. So not that far from where I grew up.
Okay.
So that always interested me, that he grew up in a shack and then became sort of a hanger-on with the rich and wrote this book based on his interviews of, mm-hmm. of the robber barons in the late 19th century. And then last, there's the Mishnah, or the Midrash,
right.
which are Jewish Midrash. Writings, commentaries on the Bible. So this poem combines elements from those, all those three.
Well, you got a mouthful coming up.
I do. Let's see how this works. The Depot, 1932. I walk in through the depot, passing under the Pawnee chief and his pony. I have never been here before, but the suffering is familiar. A woman in a cloth coat sobs. What coldness have I felt? What dark days seen? I can relate, the man beside her says, as he puts down the commercial traveler and opens his sample case. He beckons to me, and the woman wipes her eyes. We see two rows of vials tucked into the elastic bands and a motto burned in the leather. You will get exactly and only what you ask for. Lady and gentlemen, he says, clearly you are spiritual beings of refinement, able to savor the wares I will show. And this vial is water from Hiddekel, one of the rivers of Eden, where Eve first beat her laundry on a stone and learned to whistle like a blackbird as she worked. And in this vial are three of the tears dropped from angels' eyes into the eyes of Isaac when his father fixed him to the altar. They have the power of saving those in trouble with just one catch. They blind the soul they save. The traveler looks at the woman. "Those tears are a pearl that you shed for love," he says. "But what do you want? For you will get exactly and only what you ask for." "A ticket out of here," she says, "going anywhere, so long as I leave soon and travel fast." He slips off his shoe, pulls out a ticket. "This one will take you home," he says, "wherever that is." She takes it and runs through the gate. He looks at me, his finger on my lip. "Don't ask," he says, "till you know what you're asking for."
Right. You might get it. Bob, I think it's time for you to make a call.
Let me see what I can do here. Just to remind everybody, we're listening to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro, your community radio station, and we are in here at Claudio's Speakeasy with the man himself, Claudio, issuing us through whatever we're going to be doing here today. Go ahead. You better jump.
Trying to fly this thing is all I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to fly
this
thing.
That's okay. We'll take some after-hours lessons. Rocco couldn't be here today. He had to check out one of his homes in Western Carolina, I believe. So
yeah, so you got the third team here.
That's where he be. That's right. And Bob's been kind enough to co-host with me. So every once in a while we hit a snag, but this is no concern really. The beautiful poetry you just heard was by Stan Apsher, who is my guest today on the Speakeasy. Earlier I did a maritime piece from my book, but you've got quite a collection here, so I would just as soon continue. I did want to ask Bob one thing, and that was, I think you had a little commentary to go with my introduction this morning, that today is actually the anniversary of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, which he wrote in 1885.
Well, it was published in 1885.
Published then, yes.
That's quite all right.
He wrote many, many, many hours before then.
Yes, yeah, we all know how that goes.
Yeah.
But the book has become very controversial lately. So because of some of the language used in it, it had
the N-word in particular.
Yeah, it's in there. But the point that Twain always made, because he was criticized for that in his own time, was that he was writing in the vernacular of the time. This was actually the first book ever written, for at least in the States, in the vernacular of the time. So he was trying to show what it was like in the 1840s, 50s, when Huckleberry and his friend Jim sailed down the Mississippi. And he wrote it in the dialects of the South.
And praises to him for that, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and someone mentioned earlier that he actually wrote it in about multiple dialects, actually, so that when you're going through Arkansas, the Arkansas people are talking in the dialect of that time there, and Louisiana, the same thing. So if you can pick it up, there are multiple dialects. So it's a fascinating read, and it was done properly. So
I wonder how much of this he wrote on one of them riverboats and then picked up the accents along the way.
Well, I'm sure that was part of it.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we all do that.
Yeah.
Nothing like having a floating writing table.
Yeah.
And I must say that Huckleberry Finn was one of my formative experiences. Mm-hmm. My father loved...
And mine as well.
He loved both Tom Sawyer and mm-hmm. Huckleberry Finn.
Absolutely.
And we didn't read the whole books, but he would read extended passages out of those.
And there's no way they don't grab a kid's attention.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Right. So he loved reading the part where Pap appears, which is kind of a gothic scene almost. It's very scary, you know, because Huck is not expecting it, although he's been fearing it. And the other scene he read, which I never thought of it till this moment, but maybe affects how I approach poetry, that is often from a moment or of ethical decision or afterwards, the maybe written after that decision has been made. One of my dad's favorite sections in Huckleberry Finn was the little passage where Huck decides the best thing to do is to tell the truth.
Yep.
Always in the past, a lie has always been preferable, both practically and morally in his mind, But here's one time where telling the truth is really the best option. And it puzzles him. It's an ethical dilemma,
yeah,
or conundrum for him, right? That would actually be the case where the truth is preferable.
Right. What was the one of the famous sayings that came from Mark Twain himself? I prefer to tell the truth because it's so much easier to remember.
Right.
Absolutely.
If I can pitch one other thing.
Oh, absolutely.
As you mentioned, a very nice introduction. I am also a recent member of the board of the North Carolina Poetry Society. And I just want, for anyone listening who's a poet in North Carolina or outside North Carolina for that matter, because we have members from outside the state, mm-hmm, the Poetry Society is a great organization. We have several programs during the year. So I'll mention the next one coming up is the Sam Ragan Poetry Festival.
All right. We were speaking of Sam Ragan earlier.
Yeah, we were, actually. And this is in honor of him. It's on March 22nd at the Weymouth Center for the Arts and Humanities in Southern Pines.
Wonderful.
It'll be another famous North Carolina.
Sam Ragan Country.
Sam Ragan Country. He was the editor of the paper there.
Right. Pilot. I was actually written up in the Pilot newspaper.
Wow. Wow. So one of the readers will be Fred Chappell, another very famous,
wonderful,
North Carolina writer.
Yeah.
He and his wife will be reading from his works. And then in the afternoon, the Sacrificial Poets, which is a local group,
yes,
in Chapel Hill, will be reading, or performing. So I think this would be a very great experience for those who want to come and taste the variety.
Absolutely.
From a history and to the modern spoken word poetry. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a great experience.
And in the realm of one of North Carolina's greatest, Sam Ragan.
Yeah. We also have a poetry contest that's closed this year. It'll open up in November 1st. I manage that contest.
Through the
Poetry Society.
And
let me just point you to their website, ncpoetrysociety.org, all one word. And it'll tell you about the events, when the contest is open, et cetera. Now, this year we had 700 poems entered in the 10 contests.
Wow.
Which was a lot to manage, I have to tell you.
And you just chose three or four, right? That's it?
Well, no, I send them to the judges. We have...
Right. No, I realize that. But.
Right. So so from each contest, the Poet Laureate contest is unusual. There's one winner, no runner-up, no honorable
mentions.
Oh, I
see. All right.
And the Poet Laureate picks that winner.
Gotcha.
So he has the 10 finalists in his hands as we speak. And some of those are excellent poems, I have to say.
No
I didn't
doubt.
Read every poem that came in, but I read those, and they're excellent. And then we have 9 other judges, all out of state. And everything is judge blind, so when you find a poem, it could be by a famous poet or someone no one's ever heard of, but it gets judged,
mm-hmm,
the same. And some of those results have come in, but most haven't.
And what he means by blind is that the names are taken off.
Right, right. And the name should not be anywhere on the manuscript.
Right.
Yeah.
So don't try to filter it into the poem.
That's right. I've often thought about that.
In my case, I, Claudius.
I've often thought about having a poem where the lines began A-B-S-H-E-R, A-B-S-H-E-R,
yeah, right.
A-B-S-H-E-R.
Perfect.
Just to see if that would be caught.
Take that to Japan and see what you can do with it. Well, let's have another one from you.
Okay.
I like your little backgrounds on these things.
Okay,
so
let me...
continue on.
This has less background. This is apparently my most popular poem because it's been published the most. It first appeared in, Visions International, which I'll say a nice word about. It's out of Austin, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It publishes every, I think it's not quite every month, but close to monthly, translations from Eastern Europe.
Hmm.
And particularly from the little languages, like Ruthenian, Slovenian.
Okay.
But then, you know, Russian and Polish. So there are a number of translations and then a number of other poems. And it has writers in it. Regular writers from Dubai, I believe, South Africa,
okay,
from around the world, England, mm-hmm, and U.S., of course. So I've been happy and lucky to be published there several times.
Wonderful.
So this poem first appeared there and appeared in my book, Night Weather, that you mentioned earlier.
Night Weather. Mm-hmm.
And then one of the reviews of Night Weather actually showed this entire poem.
Oh, good.
So they thought it was one of the high points of the book. So this poem, the couple backgrounds, Ripeness Is All is the title. Many will recognize that as coming from King Lear, a very,
mm-hmm,
famous line,
yes,
and theme out of King Lear.
Which I think Ira David Wood is putting on as we speak, or may have just ended. I'm not sure. Him and Linda Clark, I believe.
That's a hard play to watch, I have to say. It's a hard play to read, too, for that matter. It's so wrenching.
Oh, yeah.
What happens in it.
Yeah.
And the other background here is that it's a kind of deep background. It never surfaces in the poem. My father killed himself in 1977. So this is sort of my way of thinking what he might have been thinking at some point in that process that he went through.
So you're following along the lines of the intensity you speak of.
Yeah. So ripeness is all. Wading the low branches, vermilion splotched with apple green. It hangs at easy reach, not quite ready to pick, but turn his eye away one moment, it will bruise with neglect. The moment never comes when it falls easily to hand. By day it holds the stem like a hooked red eye, then overnight spikes itself on the stubble. When is my time, he wonders. When will I, trembling with plenty, let go into the ripe void? When will I steer drunkenly into the blade?
Very eloquent, though. And I can relate, I lost a family member to the same method. Yeah. That must have been... I hope that worked as a bit of a purging for you, even though it doesn't have that eventual release. It's more facing.
My third book, which hopefully will be accepted shortly, I've been working on it for quite a long time. It's out to a publisher now, so I hope it'll get accepted. But it's really about the life of my father. So
what's it called?
My current title, I'm not sure the publisher accepted, is The VP of Banking, which my father was, Hears the Green Noise of the World.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know what white noise is,
mm-hmm.
right? And you know what pink noise
yes.
and black noise, right? Well, green noise is what some audio engineers have described the ambient noise outside. That's green noise.
Oh, okay. So, I thought money was going to filter into this somehow.
Well, it does, right? I mean, so one of the poems in the book, and I don't have it with me, and it's quite long, is a seduction poem.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Where he is seduced by, you know, an executive in the bank higher than him to bug the IRS. Now, this actually happened. On the same September that the Watergate plumbers broke into Daniel Ellsberg's office, my father, at the behest of his employer, bugged an office that the IRS was using in his bank to conduct an audit.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's a long story. I won't get into it. Then my father went on. He was so upset. He had many issues in his life, but I think this was the tipping point. He went on disability. And this is the time I was in France, too, and I really didn't know a lot of this was happening. I was in France for 2 years. But when the old man that ran the bank died, the board felt they were out from under his thumb, and they had they hired an independent counsel to do an investigation. It was written up, and the things they found my father had only told me about, but he knew these things were happening, got sent to the SEC and the FDIC. They sent it to the FBI, who in this little town of North Wilkesboro in May 1977 descended en masse and went through. And so my father said, okay, went to a lawyer and said, I need to tell the FBI something important. Will you represent me? And the lawyer said, if you tell the absolute truth and the full truth, I will represent you free. So dad then goes to the government and says, you didn't know this at the time, but on behalf of the bank, I bugged the IRS doing an audit. I'll bet that your conference room in the bank is also being bugged. And they swept it, and sure enough, in the receiver of the phone was a bug.
Hmm.
So the trial happened this was in May or June when they found the bug. The trial happened in September, October. My father and the executive of the bank, now the president of the bank, was found guilty of bugging the IRS or the FBI and probably other things.
Right.
And then my father killed himself that December right before Christmas.
My Lord, so sorry to hear that.
But, sure. But so I've been sort of wrestling with this, and my father had an interesting and difficult childhood, and he had other issues, so it's a kind of, I'm not sure you have gothic poetry, but in a ways it kind of is in terms of the events that occur in it.
Yeah.
Other than the poem I just read, I don't really have anything here from that book, but.
You know, it's funny, I've actually been reflecting on this particular thing because since my father died last week, but it's funny. The things that we take on, the psychological abuses that we suffer from our parents in pretty much any culture, often forgetting to reflect on abuses that they themselves came from.
Right.
So it's never simple.
No, and one of the poems that Visions International also published is a sonnet And I remember this based on a real event. My father came. He'd found I'd written something fantasizing suicide. I was ninth grade or something. I think it was prose. I don't remember. It was red ink, though. I do remember that for whatever reason. He found it, was shocked, and came to me and said, you know, you're not going to do this, are you? You'll talk to us. Right? And
we made Lord.
And we kind of made a deal about that. Of course, it was many years later when he killed himself, but that portrait, that sonnet kind of reflects on that.
Yeah.
But again, through his life and some thinking, what are the choices he made? The choice he made twice to go work for the bank that ended up, you know, leading him astray or set up the situation where he went astray. And the other choices he had and didn't have is kind of what that book's centered around.
You think the choices that he did make in the regard of making a living were just because it was easy? Easy to fall into
it
professionally?
Easy. It was partly a family influence.
Okay.
His brother sort of first got him a job as a manager of a discount, a finance company where you high interest loans.
Oh, I see. Gotcha.
To people that can't otherwise buy cars. So dad managed that, had a nervous breakdown, left that, went to do other things, sell cars and drive trucks and other things. But then the money was better there, and his brother and the bank kind of dragged him back in and made him a VP.
Mm-hmm.
When you have five kids at home and they're coming up on college and, you know, have to feed them and clothe them.
You have to have a practical sense. Not to mention the psychological pressure that came from it being familial. So
exactly.
To speak.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the people that ran the bank were, many of them were his childhood friends, you know, known all of his life. So,
yeah, so there was far too much in that fabric.
Right. But he would have been far happier, if a lot poorer, if he had done something that kept him outside.
And I think that's so true for so many of us. Well, let's have more.
Okay, well, so I'm going to read two poems now. I talked about the Depot was reflecting the influence of Shakespeare and that great writer, Napoleon Hill. And I'm laughing as I say that, by the way. Radio, you can't tell that, but I'm smiling.
Yes.
So this one, I'm going to read a poem by Friedrich Hölderlin, a great German poet, in the English translation, and then my answer to that. Because I've noticed what I'm doing these days is writing answers to poems, or not necessarily refuting, just a response to.
Just to let you folks, remind you folks who've actually thrown the radio out the window by now, this is Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theater. I am, my honored guest here is Stan Apsher, the poet, and he's also on the NC Poetry Society board. He's here to entertain us with his poetry and just his life in general.
Right. So let's start with Hölderlin. At the middle of life, the earth hangs down to the lake, full of yellow pears and wild roses. Lovely swans, drunk with kisses, you dip your heads into the holy, sobering waters. But when winter comes, where will I find the flowers, the sunshine, the shadows of the earth? The wall stands speechless and cold. The weather vanes rattle in the wind. So that's Hölderlin. Nice poem.
I like it.
So I've started writing, I suppose, to memorialize the passing of time, birthday poems. So on turning 61, I just saw Hölderlin's poem and wrote this one. Afterlife's middle, on turning 61. Trees hang lower into the river, dipping golden and scarlet manes. Brighter than last year, I think, maybe the brightest ever. It's good that things get better. The Eno runs red and yellow as I wade in waist deep, out of the easy shallows. Was water ever wetter? A colleague at work read that. I sent it to him.
Any historical perspectives to offer us today, Mr. Bob Crowley, our friend and historian here? That was wonderful work from you. I figured we'd switch around a little bit.
Yeah that's fine. Historical perspectives. Well,
you're always coming out with what day today is or what.
Well, I gave you the date when
with
Mark Twain and so on, but. No, I can't think of anything.
Anything going on with the Apex Arts Council?
We've got some things happening there, actually, on March 1st. We're working with the Apex Downtown Business Association to create a Founders Day in Apex, kind of a birthday party for the town of Apex. It's not going to be like our normal Peak Fest with vendors and such. This will be a celebration of the history of the town. We'll have reenactors there from the Civil War. We'll have demonstrations of blacksmithing and weaving and how you shear a sheep and weave the wool together and all that stuff. And I'm actually I'm online for that. I'm to give one of the walking tours of Apex. Now, the there are people from the Historical Association that will do that, and they will give you all the wonderful stuff about Apex. I'm to give the walking tour on the other side of Apex. The ghosts, the murders, the shootouts, the drunken brawls, and some of the other seamier side of Apex without being too obscene about it. So that
sounds like a job for you. I can see it.
It's going to be fun. I mean, we're going to tell you about all kinds of fun stuff there.
I can see you in that white Green Street suit,
yeah,
taking people around.
Yeah, well, we're gonna do that. So if you want to be in Apex on Saturday, the 1st of March, definitely come on over and see what's going on with our Founders Day.
Wonderful. Well, I just wanted you to have a chance to give a little cue in and any contact information about the Arts Council, please.
Yeah, and of course, you're going to be in Apex before too much longer, right? We've got the Farmers Market going to be opening
That's
up in
right.
April.
I'm putting on my chef's uniform again, yes.
Yeah, everybody's got to come back to the Farmers Market and see what's going on. We're going to do some fun and different things there. But
I think it opens back up in April, isn't it?
April, yeah. April 4th, first Saturday in April. So definitely want to be there. We're going to have the new mayor of Apex and the town council there to cut a ribbon and open it up and have all kinds of fun stuff happening. So Apex, a happening place, folks. Come on out. As far as the Arts Council.
And it hasn't been swallowed up by Kerry.
And never will be.
No.
We have people armed.
Those are the teeth I was looking for. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have armed people waiting for that to be tried. But if you want to find out more about what the Apex Arts Council is doing, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on the web at www.apexartscouncil.org. O-R-G. So you see there everything that we're doing, all the fun stuff. And even Mr. Claudio does some things there. He does theatrical and movie reviews for us there. So,
oh, that's right. Look on the Apex Arts Council website, Apex Arts Council website, which is .org, apexartscouncil.org.
.org, yep.
And I do film and art reviews. And it's really sort of a very eclectic mix of things.
And he's got a wonderful tribute up there now to Nelson Mandela that's well worth reading.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad you put that up there for me. Mm-hmm. I basically write it, I pass it on to Bob, and he gets it done.
I do the magic.
That's how it works. Well, we've got 5 minutes left, so I'm going to do a wrap with maybe some closing poetry you'd like to read, and then give us all the contact information again. Stan Apsher is with us in the studio today. This is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Back to Stan on WCOM 103.5 FM.
Thank you. So, contact information.
Please.
My email, if you were interested about any of this, stanapsher@hotmail.com. It's A-B-S-H-E-R. The Poetry Society is www.ncpoetrysociety.org, or you can just Google NC Poetry
Absolutely,
Society.
Absolutely, yeah.
And Flyleaf Books is www.flyleafbooks.com, I believe.
Oh, look it up in case you
Look it up. It's .com. Yeah.
It's
.com.
It's an institution here.
It is an institution and a great bookstore. I always try to buy a book every time I go in just to support it.
I'll do the same next time I pass it.
Let me read a poem from my first book, The Burial Van of Shepherds. It's the key poem in many respects.
What's it called again?
The book is The Burial of Van of Shepherd.
Oh, right.
It's really the poem is called The Man from Sweet Hollow. This is a murder poem. My grandfather was murdered in 1938. So this is the story of that murder. It was a racial incident.
Mm.
What's interesting and sad is that no one really knows why the murder happened.
To this day.
And my sister did the research when she was an undergrad at Appalachian State as an adult, did the research, interviewed people, looked at what was left of the court records, and it's not really clear, even from those records, what actually happened. So the poem, and the reason I introduced it, I hope not to give the poem away, but it gives multiple incidents of what happened because there are multiple versions in quote, history of what happened. So the poem is not really contradicting itself, it's just history. The Man from Sweet Hollow. In May of 21, Annis Irwin, in a beaded dress of sheer green gauze, met Charlie Shepherd beneath bright heaven to marry their sorrows and joys. She'd play hymns on the piano, he'd sing of the cross and cry. He'd play his banjo southpaw, the devil's fire in his eye for the couples who threaded a circle out the storeroom to the moonlight, hands high, feet in a whirl, through the front room door back to lamplight. The babies came. He patted her belly, built a store, made deputy. She sold the groceries, crocheted doilies pretty as flowering elderberry. Blessings flowed down thick and fierce, raising Annis nigh to heaven's jealous love that burns and pierces. She kept her own heart hidden. In the warmth of one mid-April, the sun hung sweet as a pear. When a hard worker of good character, a seven white men would swear. Maxwell, that Shepherd had given credit and sometimes hired, three times loaded his shot, three times aimed and fired. Struck Shepherd down in the garden while his mother looked around. Shot him once as he tried to run, twice as he lay on the ground. Surprised to see those little holes bunched in his side like grapes. Neighbors running and birds flying into darker and darker shapes. Under his head he felt a moving mouth of dirt, its gravelly tongue and throat watering at his hurt. Folks talked. Deputy Shepherd had knocked down Maxwell's son with an axe that weighed 4 pounds, or with the butt of his gun had knocked him off his nag, or pushed him backwards into a ditch to shake off a drunken hug, had called him son of a bitch. And the boy had gone to daddy, his shirt torn and bloody. Maxwell had got his gun, or borrowed one from a buddy. Found poor Charlie with a hoe, chopping the lamb's quarter, as innocent as Adam, setting his garden to order. Struck him down as he worked, while his mama looked around. Shot him twice as he tried to run, once bleeding on the ground. Those who looked for truth found it where they looked. Colored to make their hearts beat hard and trigger fingers crook.
And that was Stan Apsher. Stan, I want to thank you for joining the Claudio Speakeasy family.
Oh, thank you very much.
And consider yourself a member, which means we'll do more shows in the future.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I tend to make families out of people I like having on.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Consider yourself among them. And Bob, thank you for your assistance today.
Anytime.
And folks, thank you out there for tuning us in. This is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater. Until next time, I would like at the very ending of the show just to give a little dedication to all the souls that we have lost. Most recently, my father, and obviously your own writings reflect everything you've gone through, and I know there was something even more recent. I'd like to just something by Khalil Gibran comes to mind, and I think this speaks well for all of them. The fear of death is a delusion, harbored in the breast of sages. For he who lives a single springtime is like one who's lived for ages. That's the Speakeasy, signing off. Cheers.